DW Africa Link.
Today, I'm here to talk about bridging roots, where I, a local, dive into the deep, enduring wisdom of indigenous people, where we explore the vibrant culture and ancient wisdom of the Baka people, guardians of Africa's rainforests and masters of a world most of us have never truly seen. It's crucial that we understand and appreciate the importance of preserving the Baka culture, a culture that is not just unique, but also vital to the balance of our planet. Stay tuned. My name is Josie Mahachi. Welcome to Africa Link, the podcast that connects you to the stories that matter from Africa.
Africa Link, every weekday here on DW.
In the face of relentless change, older women among Cameroon's indigenous Baka people are taking desperate steps to preserve their culture. Displaced from their forest homes by logging, mining, agriculture, and conservation efforts, the Baka now find their traditional way of life under immediate threat. The government's push for more durable modern structures as a sign of inclusion means that future generations may never see the traditional Baka huts known as Mongulu that their ancestors lived in. However, the community's older women are determined to save what they can. You must be curious, just as I am, to know more of these people. So to help us do that is Dr. Fabrice Lamfu from Greenpeace, an organization focused on nature preservation and conservation. Also joining us from Cameroon is DW correspondent Kiliam Chimtom. We will start with you, Dr. Lamfu. Can you start by painting an overall picture for us on who exactly are the Baka people?
Okay, so in Cameroon, we actually have some indigenous people, I think about five of them in number. And the Baka people, similarly to the Bagili, these are people of the forest. You know, they actually are found in the south and also part of them in the west region. Some of them actually migrated to Congo Brazzaville from the south region. Okay, they have similar characteristics, and these are people who have track record of living in the forest.
But how do they recognize each other that we are the Baka people? What's so unique about them beyond what you just said?
For them to recognize themselves is pretty much easy, you know, from their language. That's one of the things. And one other thing phenotypically which could be recognized with them, one is their feeding habit. The other thing is their height, which, you know, many people now attribute them to be short people, which is true at some particular, and also their facial makeup. You know, these are all phenotypical characteristics which you can actually identify them. And of course, the fact that they lived in the forest, not very used to living with the city or living in the midst of Bantus, you know, people. Again, one could actually misjudge them or not to identify them properly. It's because of the fact that, you know, their culture and language, which is easily identifiable, is disappearing. So, and a whole lot of mixed, breed happening within the communities where they find themselves.
I'll come back to you, Dr. Lamfu, just for us to talk more on. I really want to understand how they got to be their ancestors, what year, how they discovered that they're different and that they need to live in the forest. But Kilian, you are a reporter. When you did reports on them, are they happy with their lives and what are their thoughts about development?
I did talk to some Baka pygmies in the East region, and they are not very much happy with the fact that the forest is disappearing as a result of logging, as a result of mining, as a result of development efforts. And I speak to a 78-year-old woman who said she's not just happy that these conservation efforts have simply pushed them out of the forest. She believes that it is critical that the Baka pygmies continue to live the way they used to live. Their lifestyle is about going into the forest, hunting game, gathering wild fruits, gathering honey and then surviving on all of that. And she was telling me that the forest to the baka is like a pharmacy. When you're sick, you simply get to the forest and you get the basic medication that you need.
You mentioned something mm-hmm. earlier about mm-hmm. them. Now the language is changing, obviously, because now it's becoming a new mm-hmm. generation, right? And the older people are probably mm-hmm. maybe passing on whatever. So do you ever see thoughts mm-hmm. of development, or they will continue this way, even looking at the younger generation?
I'm afraid, from the Bagili and the Baka, in 10, 15 years to come, it will be history, you know, in terms of this group of people, you know, living. I think as Africans, we all have roots directed to the forest. And that's the more reason why, from Greenpeace, we actually acknowledged the forest of Africa as a sacred forest. You know, like Kilamed mentioned, it's more like a supermarket, you know, where you get all of your stuff. And apart from that, the communication with ancestors, you know. And the impact of the agro-industrial business and, the extractive industries cannot be overemphasized. But again, it has tremendous impact on the livelihood and how the community actually are being perceived. Because like Amit mentioned, in 10 years to come, the language are fast disappearing, and the Sagmalema and the Kribi axis in the communities which are visited, you know, a lot of people don't want to go back again to this forest, you know, most probably because they have actually tasted, you know, what the life is all about. But again, the new breeds that are actually coming up, you know, some don't even know the language. Some speak French, you know, some speak the Bantu. Very few of them speak the Bagili or the Baka language, you know. So that is actually my fear. And the truth is, this is going to disappear with no time, you know, and this species of people will not even be recognized, just be read by a book and not even pointing the finger at them. Again, a lot of them are actually being intimidated by the Bantu where they live, you know. So this could actually be a factor where, you know, they don't want to associate themselves as Baka because, one, most of the Cameroon ratification in terms of law has done that for them, but again, they're not actually being enforced. So they're all, intimidated at different levels, from the community level, you know, even up to the government, you know, officials. So
now, Killian, now to just come back to you, we were talking about the risk of younger generations losing their connection to traditional practices and knowledge. Just tell us on that aspect, especially in the context of globalization and modernization.
Yes, Josie, when I went to some of these settlements, what I discovered is that you have these older women who are actually coming out and building some of these traditional huts that the Bakas used to live in the forest. And the reason they are doing that is to make sure that the younger generation, they do not completely lose what they used to have in terms of their culture, in terms of the places where they used to live. Then within the context of globalization, we are not going to remember the Baka the way they used to live. So this lady was telling me that she's actually constructed what they call the Mongolo. The Mongolo is the traditional Baka hut. That is the house they used to live in the forest. And the intention is to make sure that the younger generation, the children yet unborn, grew to know that their forebears used to live in those kinds of structures. And it really goes beyond just shelter. I think it's a whole culture that is embodied in all of that. And I say this because I remember the Cameroon's first lady actually constructed some modern houses for the Bakas in the east some time ago, and they rejected those houses. Many of them denied that they were not going to live in those modern structures. So it tells you how culturally attached people could be to their culture and to the way they used to live. So I think besides their language that is almost being lost, like Doctor indicated, that maybe these physical attributes of their culture should be left standing so they can at least remember where they came from.
Mm. Now, Doctor, just to touch more on what Killian said, what does the Mongolo hut represent for the Baka people beyond just being shelter as symbols of identity and connection to the forest?
Okay, so I'll just give reference to one of the celebrations we did in the forest, and this had to be constructed. You know, this identified them mostly to their forefathers, because I visited a lot of their ritual sites in the forest where I stayed about 10 days, you know, just to understand their culture, understand their lifestyle. This could actually help me, you know, more to communicate. So this, again, just make them to have a reflection that this is, you know, where their forefathers used to live. And that connection actually comes out with them. Most of the younger generation, like, you know, in terms of their disappearance of the culture, don't even know how this can be set up. It's more like the remembrance of, you know, their forefathers, where they used to live and stuff like that. Yeah. Things similar in Yaoundé as Greenpeace, where we had to construct this and let people understand that, you know, this is something from literature. So this is something protecting, you know.
Just take us through this experience. What were you eating? What is their lifestyle like? What do they do when they wake up? Just take us through the day, please. That's quite interesting.
Yeah, my whole aim was actually to communicate and to understand what these people actually have, you know, in order for me to come up with strategy to protect it. And as such, yeah, I had to move 30 kilometers into the forest with no light, no water, you know, no internet, you know. So I had to eat their food using all the traditional stuff which they prepare, using their own groundnuts, you know, using their own oil, which is actually been extracted from nuts, you know. I had to drink their water, you know. I had to do hunting with them in the night, you know. And again, one of the things that came out that was very, very striking to me, which they told me, was the fact that I did not come with a bad spirit, because if I came with a bad spirit, I wouldn't have left the forest. You know, it's something which they always do that. And again, they actually prayed for me when I was leaving. So when I shared this with some of the people who have actually worked with Baka, they said it was actually more of a blessing, because they rarely do that to people. You know, and so one of the things, again, which I actually picked out very, very good, is that these people are the best when it comes to conservation, because when we went out hunting in the night, you know, they have sounds to call different species of animals, you know, and if this animal appears to them, you know, comes to them, and they notice that it's actually a female who is very active in terms of productivity, they're going to send it away. You know, if it's a male who is aged and is not more very, very productive, they're going to kill it up, you know, and use it for their stuff. So these are some of the things which I actually learned. You know, I learned how they did their fishing, you know, how they did their daylight hunting, and even in the night, you know, they showed me a lot of medicinal trees, you know, which I actually got some out of a forest, you know. So it was a very good experience. And with this, you can best, you know, communicate what these people actually have in terms of potentials. And they took me to a lot of their camps where their forefathers used to live, you know, back in those days, as 200 years ago, where they had to show me different camps and their different names and what it means to them and stuff like that, you know, and the different songs which they sing, you know, how they could actually predict, you know, if a lady is pregnant and what sex of the child is that lady carrying, you know. So there's a whole lot of stuff in Jones knowledge which is actually being minimized and has not been harnessed. By the time we understand this indigenous knowledge, then it will be worth protecting, even the companies that are actually coming on board.
Now, as we just wrap up quickly, because we've run out of time, how can development initiatives be made more inclusive of these people, talking of indigenous knowledge and cultural practices?
Yeah, I think the key is actually consultation, free prior informed consent. We have to consult them right from the initiation for them to actually bring in what they feel that could be done, you know, in order for whatsoever project, you know, is supposed to be implemented in their region. And please, the ideas which they give should not be undermined, because that is actually the fundamentals of what they actually have for that particular area and the setting.
And Killian, quick words before we close up.
Yes, I would just say that it's very important that the indigenous people should be included in the development process. And part of that is what Dr. said earlier on about identification. These people don't have access to identification papers, and that is actually putting them on the brink of statelessness. So I think that if they have to be considered as part and parcel of, should be given, they should be, their access to identification papers, birth certificates, national identity cards should be facilitated.
Many thanks, Dr. Fabrice Lamfu from Greenpeace, an organization that is focusing on nature preservation and conservation, and also our own DW correspondent, Killiam Chintom. At the Africa Link podcast, we always look across the continent to see how the stories and issues we are dealing with play out or at times even overlap. The famous Yoruba people, one of the largest indigenous ethnic groups in Africa, have survived for centuries on the African continent. The Yoruba are a dominant indigenous ethnic group in Nigeria. So what lessons can be learned from this indigenous group? To help us understand, we have Dr. Olawale Akinwumi, a respected scholar and an expert on African indigenous. Thank you so much for joining us today here on DW Africa Link, a podcast. We are talking about indigenous people. We just want to understand from you, Dr. Akinwumi, what makes the Yoruba culture and tradition stand out in Nigeria?
Consistency. Consistency in the area of their craft, their artistic. They have a pattern of doing things. Their dressing is unique. The tradition, let's say, for example, marriage, wedding ceremony, unique. And they've not changed for thousands of years. They've been consistent doing the same thing and passing down the same thing to their children and their grandchildren. They also like to do what we call folk tales, to tell their children stories of the past that they also took from their fathers and their grandfathers. So the Yoruba people have been consistent.
Can you just tell us more about this culture, Dr. Akinwumi, especially when it comes to naming ceremonies? I see that Yoruba names always have a meaning.
Yes, they've been doing things the same way for thousands of years. When it comes to naming, they will say in Yoruba land, I will interpret for you, Ile Lawo Kiato Somoloruko, meaning that every name has a meaning, so they look inward. Before naming a child, there must be a reason. For example, my names are Olawale, wealth has come home. Oladimeji, wealth is doubled. Oladapo, wealth has multiplied. So we look at incidents, we look at histories, we look at circumstances in naming, in giving a new baby, born baby names in Africa or in Yoruba land, let me put it that way. I named one of my children after my late father for a particular reason, because their birth seems similar. So those are the things you see in Yoruba land. They don't just give names to children. There must be a reason behind it. There must be a meaning behind that name.
So your parents really wanted you to have so much money, so much wealth. Eh? Olawale, you said wealth has come.
Yes. Wealth has come home.
Uh-huh.
Oladimeji. Wealth has doubled.
Okay.
Oladapo. Wealth has multiplied. Wealth.
Interesting. And when you mentioned something about their weddings, you say that they're so consistent. You're talking about naming ceremony. I was also referring to the fact that I think when a child is born, they are not given a name immediately, right?
Yes. A child is given a name after on the eighth day. Yorubas are spiritual and they are very, very sensitive. It is believed that a child is circumcised on the eighth day. So be it a male or a female, the child will be named on the eighth day in Yoruba land.
Okay. Now, have you faced any challenges such as integration across the country?
No. Yorubas are accepted everywhere. We have a unique culture and tradition. And I will tell you, and that is respect. We respect people a lot. So even where you don't ordinarily, where you ordinarily will not want us, because we show you so much respect, you will accept us. We don't greet our parents standing.
Absolutely, I've seen that.
As a male child, you prostrate. As old as I am, I've got to prostrate. If you're a female, you've got to kneel down. It's not, you're not just bowing, you are going flat. So when you honor people, we see it as honoring. So when you honor people from other areas where you want to be accepted, they will definitely accept you. Honor brings acceptance.
We've seen that even if it looks like no matter how much money you have, it's all about respect. You know, we see when Davido, the global artist, whenever he meets elders, he does that. And you see people on social media platforms actually, you know, embracing that. And for you to be saying that no matter how old you are, no matter who you are, we have to be doing that. I think it's something that other cultures should learn from you. Have you seen other cultures maybe emulating that as well, Dr. Akinwumi?
Not really, but it is a good thing for them to emulate, because you can easily favor a man or a woman that shows you respect, even when he or she does not deserve it.
Well,
it is something that has been passed down, and it works for the Yorubas.
Now, despite pressures from globalization and the dominance of English and the English culture, the Yoruba language continues to thrive both locally and in the diaspora. We've also even seen Yoruba songs trending in the world. I can give examples of artists like Asake. I think it's Asake or Asake. Yeah, he sings
Asake.
He sings in Yoruba and it's well accepted. How has it become a symbol of cultural pride and unity among Yoruba people worldwide?
I'll give you an example. I went to the US for a function and I branched to see my cousin in Maryland. And my cousin's children spoke Yoruba to me. They've never been to Nigeria. They've never been to Yoruba land. They were born and bred in the US. So where am I going to? Our parents taught us to speak Yoruba at home. We can speak English in school. We can speak English at work. But at home, we speak Yoruba to ourselves. Mm. We maintain that language in the family. There are parents that I am still a bit milder. I can still tolerate my children putting English in between Yoruba. There are some parents in Yoruba land, you cannot. It is a taboo to speak another language in the house. When you are out of the house, you can go with your English, but in the house, you must speak Yoruba. And also, we encourage ourselves to wear our traditional attire, to dress as Yoruba people. Yeah, and that is why you go to the US, you see Oyo Tunji as an extension of Oyo Empire in the US. You go to Brazil, you see Yoruba people. You go to Benin Republic, you see Yoruba people. We've maintained this by ensuring that this communal communication is not diluted. So we speak Yoruba to ourselves wherever we find ourselves.
How has the strength of the Yoruba diaspora contributed to the survival and even flourishing of Yoruba culture beyond Nigeria? And what lessons can other indigenous groups learn from this global network?
Okay. We have most of our people in diaspora are maintaining the culture. They like to wear the Yoruba attire. Yes, they wear suits. They wear the English wear, rather, so to say. But they send money home. They to sew for them. So the traditional agbada, for the Yoruba dressing style, and send to them in the US, in the UK, all over the world. So they maintaining their culture. They are always happy when you are traveling and they know you are coming. It's okay. Can you bring adire for me? Can you bring this for me? I need to wear. I want to be wearing it. So they interact there and speak Yoruba among themselves. When you see Yoruba people in the UK gathering together, in a gathering rather, they don't speak English. They speak Yoruba because they want to. They are always conscious of where they have come from. And they've contributed a lot. And they're training their children to understand that this is where we came from. Like I just gave an example of my cousin. His children have never been to Nigeria. They've never been to Yoruba land. Yet they speak Yoruba in the US. So there, the Yorubas in diaspora are really doing even much more than those at home. Because they are in foreign lands, so they need to be connected. And the only way to be connected is to uphold the culture and the practice that they are used to at home as Yorubas.
Absolutely.
Others can learn from us because we don't joke with that. And I can tell you that there are other, the Igbos don't also joke with their culture when they are abroad. But the Yorubas are vast in this. And they are always, like I said from the beginning, consistency. They are consistent.
Consistency. So how do we wrap up this discussion without some little bit of Yoruba? Can you give me a sentence, Dr. Akinwumi, in Yoruba?
I thank you for inviting me to the program today, and I hope that I've answered you well.
Okay, what a way to end this particular discussion on the Yoruba, a dominant indigenous ethnic group in Nigeria, with Dr. Olawale Akinwumi, a respected scholar and expert on African indigenous. That's it for this edition of Africa Link. Remember, you are not just a listener, but a vital part of our community. Your feedback and participation are the lifeblood of this podcast, shaping it into what it is. We value your insights and encourage you to share your thoughts with us. Remember to click follow so you can catch all of the episodes. This podcast was co-produced and edited by Isaac Mugabi. My name is Josie Mahachi. Thanks for listening. Until next time, it's bye for now.
DW, made for minds.